This is the Unstoppable Authors Podcast with worldbuilding warrior Angeline Trevina,
planning and productivity powerhouse Holly Line,
and formatting fireball Julia Scott.
Every week we bring you discussions on the craft of writing,
author life and business,
and interviews with some of the industry's most unstoppable authors.
A writer's life doesn't have to be solitary. We're here to bust that myth, support you on your journey, and encourage you to be unstoppable. Hello and welcome to episode 149 of the Unstoppable Authors Podcast. I'm Holly Line, and today I have a fantastic interview for you with Jeff Elkins. We talked about writing a fictionalized memoir and tackling difficult subjects with sensitivity. Before we get into the interview, it's personal update time. I've had a good week, and I like that I can say that with a great big smile on my face. I've had some really nice writing days, particularly when I jump on Zoom and write with others. It's become more and more the case that I need to do that, and yet some days I still find myself resisting it. In my coaching session this week, I asked about that. Why do I resist using the systems that I know will help? The answer seems to be centered on my empathy, which is my number three strength, and keeping that happy. So when I take on too many feelings from other people and keep hold of them, I can't face seeing people on Zoom. I don't want to deal with people. And very often that bleeds into not wanting to even open the manuscript. So with a firm nudge from my coach, I got out my morning pages notebook, which has been somewhat neglected recently, and I purged a lot of the emotional weight that I've been carrying. And what do you know? Later that day, I went on to write over 3,600 words. So yeah, let this be a lesson. When you know what works for you normally, do it. I know that journaling helps, but I didn't think to try that. So sometimes it helps to talk to someone else and have these things pointed out too. I also, this week, had a lovely walk with an author friend out in nature in the sun, and it was just perfect and really rejuvenating and really good to have a good chat. So, yeah, it's been a good week. Here's to another one, just as good or even better. Now then, our question of the week. Last week, we asked you, what have you learned about your personality type that has had a significant impact on how you understand yourself? Over on Instagram, NL Blandford said, a few years ago, I took the Enneagram test and discovered that I'm a 2. I have a hard time creating boundaries and other people's opinions where I find value. This then turns into me doing more for everyone else rather than caring for myself. As such, when people ask how they can care for me, my answer is always, I don't know. It always means my writing goals tend to come last. I can now recognise when this is happening and try to pivot. That's so important. I think that's the most valuable thing about learning about your personality type, really. On the Facebook group, Heather Button said, I haven't done mine yet, I think she means strengths, because I didn't want to do it in a crush season. But I did have a thought about writing in harmony. Maybe think of it as music. You don't quite get the satisfaction of a happily ever after and harmony for all the characters without having the dissonant chords before the resolution. It makes it all the more satisfying at the end because they had to work through the dissonance and seeming chaos. I like that, and I hope Julia paid attention to that because that is very helpful advice. So thank you, Heather. Meg said, great episode. I'm here for strengths chat. I love personality tests and scientifically understanding myself, though for me these tests unveil aspects of me that deepen my self-understanding but don't wholly define it. Myers-Briggs was the first one that really opened my eyes to the power of self-understanding. I'm an INFJT. Strengths has been huge though. At first I too threw them off thinking they had simply highlighted all the things I considered weaknesses. That took some processing. Now I lean into my lovely strengths and I'm rebuilding my business and life consciously from the ground up to harness my strengths and align with my values, personality and goals. Yeah, you are, Meg. Go for it. And Edwin said, not more Clifton strengths. I haven't got a teacup big enough for this drinking game. Thanks very much, Edwin. I hope you enjoyed the episode with or without tea. This week, I want to know, what kinds of sensitive topics have you addressed with your fiction? So, patrons, we have no new patrons this week, but a huge thank you to all of our current patrons who sponsor the show. We are very close to our first goal on Patreon, though, so if you join now, you may be the one to get us to that goal, and we have something special planned for reaching that milestone. We appreciate the support of our patrons so very much. If you join now, you'll get early access to episodes, exclusive access to our off-air banter, and the chance to join in with our monthly sessions of Sprints and Giggles, an evening where we do writing sprints, answer questions, and have a laugh. Our next session is coming up very soon. If you'd like to join in and also support the show, you can do so for just £3 a month at patreon.com/unstoppableauthors. Now, without further ado, let's get into the interview with Jeff Elkins. With me today is Jeff Elkins. He writes stories about outsiders who fight for outcasts, rejects, and the oppressed. He's the author of more than 10 novels, a certified three-story method editor, and the host of the Dialogue Doctor podcast. During the day, he leads the writing team for a training company that simulates difficult conversations. He lives north of Baltimore, Maryland, with his wife of 20 years and his 5 kids. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks, Holly. It's really good to be here. I appreciate it. I always get a little concerned when somebody reads my bio, because I'm always like, do I tell them that? Is that true? I think that's true. It is true. But yeah, it's just always one of those like, it's weird to have somebody talk about you that way. But yeah.
Right.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
That's cool. I always think it's funny, you know, like we all write our bios in the third person, which is the correct thing to do, but it's, yeah, you write it and then someone else reads it and somehow it comes back sounding different and you're like,
yeah, it always comes back like, it's like, I guess I do those things. I do those. And I put that down as something that I do. But yeah, anyway, it's still weird. It's I'm having a very strange experience hearing my own bio. So yeah. Thank you. I'll rein in my neuroses. Thank you for having me on.
That's a pleasure. So tell us a bit about your writing background. How did you come to be where you are? Where did you begin?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. And you know, I love, it's a really interesting question because it's, you know, talking about, I know part of what we're going to talk about today is writing a fictionalized memoir. And so that like view of like our own story and the narrative we create around ourselves and, you know, thinking about the bio we just read, the narrative we create around ourselves and how like self-defining that is an interesting thing. Like, you know, yesterday, for example, I was in a book club I used to be a pastor. I went to seminary I haven't been for almost a decade. Which I'll tell you more about in a second, but I was in a book club with a bunch of people that I went to seminary with and an old professor of mine. And they are all still preachers and they're all still like firmly in religion. And about halfway through the book club, I was like, what am I doing here? And it's that like, because it is that like story that we tell ourselves about ourselves, like who we are and what we're doing. And so I had this moment where I was like, what am I doing here? I was like, oh, I'm searching for some part of a person that I used to be. Like, that's what I'm doing here. And, you know, so just thinking about like, how did I start writing and how did I become a writer is interesting because, you know, I don't know. It's always the identity that we have as an author, I think is always in flux. And it's always something that I find myself fighting with. Like, you know, even after this is my 13th novel that I just published and, you know, I run an editing business and I run a service and all this stuff. And even after all of that, the idea that like I'm an author is still something that like I have that internal doubt about. I think Becca Syme recently said though that like only like all people who are actually doing it always doubt whether or not they're actually doing it or something like that, that like the self-doubt is a normal thing. Sorry, anyway, that was a long ramble to say. I started adult life as a I went to seminary. I was pre-med in college. You know, my father died. I had some huge kind of turnovers and that led me into seeking changes and kind of a life around church and religion. I grew up in the church. I've always been in the church. When I was a kid, they called me a church rat, meaning that like, if the lights came on, there I was in the room. Like Jeff was like, I was just waiting for everybody to get here. Yeah, but I, So I went to seminary, started working as a pastor, worked for different churches for 15 years, and always felt very much like an outsider in those communities. Part of that is just because by my nature, just by like my personality and who I am, I question systems and I want to know, like, why do we do things the way we do them? How can we do this better? How can we be more efficient about it? And in religious structures, that isn't always welcome. The question of why is not hugely welcome. So I very much felt like an outcast from in those circles from the beginning, but I'm also incredibly loyal. So like, I was just like, all right, well, you know, there must be something wrong with me. There must be something that I'm doing wrong. And just stayed in those places. And after about 11 years of very stressful jobs, because I started being hired in churches as like, okay, well, this is the guy who's going to show up and ask why. And then we know we need somebody asking why, but we're going to hate him while he does it. So that was kind of my role, was like, oh, we're going to bring Jeff into this room with a bunch of people who don't want to change, but know they need to change. And then we're going to have Jeff ask us, why are we doing these things, so that we can emotionally process that we don't want to change. And then, you know, Jeff kind of becomes the, like, I kind of became the like person that they would rail against. I became the personification of change for a lot of places. And that's a tough role to have. And I was burning out. So one day I'm in a meeting with a bunch of them and we're talking about how they understand this concept of sin. And I'm trying to tell them that like what they believe are grounded rules in history are actually like they're based on their culture and how they view things, that they need to like back off of this understanding of like constantly condemning people, that like that has nothing to do with the like historic institution, that has to do with like their cultural context. And one of them was like, hey, would you just go write this down for us? He's like, would you go, like, instead of talking to us about it, would you just write it down? I realized now that what he was doing was trying to shut me up and like give me the end of the meeting. So I was like, I will write it down. So I went and wrote it down, and I spent a whole day and cranked out a 40,000 word pamphlet. It's the first time I'd ever written anything. I'm dyslexic. I hated English as a kid. Like, reading was very difficult for me. Writing was even worse. So, the only class I ever failed was freshman English. I wrote that my first paper I wrote in freshman college English was, he asked us to write a true story about life. I grew up in inner city New Orleans, and had some pretty rough experiences. So I wrote about one of them, and he put at the top of the paper, I told you to write a true experience, not a lie, F. And I was like, ah. So like deepened my like hatred of writing in English. I was like, this is not for me. So I didn't write until I was in my mid-30s, and I had that moment with that group. And it felt so it felt like such a release to get ideas and like images on paper. And so I immediately signed up for a course. I went to, I just Googled like writing course, and this site, The Write Practice, came up. That's run by Joe Bunting. He's fantastic. And he had a book called Let's Write a Short Story. So I read that. And then I started writing a short story every night, as like therapy for myself. Just like, I need to process these emotions. So I started writing short fiction every night. And I did that for a year. And I had, you know, by the end of the year, I had like 365 stories. So I was like, what do I do with these? And so I just started posting them to a blog. And then I was like, more people should post here too. So I made it into kind of like a literary journal. So it was called Short Fiction Break. And it was chaos and nonsense, because I had hated English. I hadn't paid attention to any grammar rules. I knew nothing about writing. So my stuff was extremely rough. And I had this attitude of like, yeah, if you send me something, like, I'm no better than you, so I'll just post your stuff too. So it really was just like this collective of like, we're all experimenting with writing for the first time. There were like 15 of us, and it was like free reign to post whatever you want. It was a chaos site. It was chaos. I ended up giving it away to Joe, because I moved into writing longer works, and Joe has made it into something really amazing. So it still exists, and it's now a really amazing place to post and like to work. But when I was in charge of it, it was just like nonsensical chaos. So I did that, and then I interviewed for, I left church work to work for a Christian organization that was battling battling human trafficking. So I took a job with them, and in my interview, they were like, hey, we see this blog you have going. We see all these short stories you have. And they're like, we don't want you writing anymore. They're like, because I wrote a lot of dark fantasy. I wrote a lot of, like, I was processing emotions through what I was doing. So a lot of horror was coming out of me. A lot of thriller was coming out of me. And they were like, that's not appropriate for the leadership of this organization to be like writing stuff. And that was a big red flag for me, but I really wanted the job. So, and part of that goes to that idea of self-definition. I was leaving the title of pastor, and I was trying to figure out, like, who am I going to be now? And so when they said that, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. That's who I'm going to be. I'll let this writer title go so that I can be, you know, director of this thing. And it ended up being one of like 1,000 red flags, and they, you know, and I was like, oh no, I'm in the same role of where I'm asking, like, why do we do what we do? And they don't actually, they want to ask that question, but they don't actually want somebody to ask it. So they fired me after 4 months. So I got really angry, and I was like desperately searching for a job. My wife was 9 months pregnant with our 5th kid. We had moved to take this job, so we'd just bought a house. And they fired me. I was like, oh, like, I had no income, no money, no nothing. And so I just started angry writing novels. And my first 3 novels are very angry. Like, they're very, like, just rage against the system novels. I think my first novel actually starts off with 2 pages of intense cussing, because I was just so, like, I was processing those emotions through the story I was telling. So I actually got a job as a writer for a tech company that simulates difficult conversations, which was a perfect fit for me. I've been there now for, again, almost a decade. And it was also great for my writing. And I was, you know, I came to them and I was like, hey, you know, my last job was like, don't write on the side. Are you guys okay if I write on the side? And they're like, yeah, we don't care. So they're like, get your work done. I don't care. So it's been a really beautiful marriage, because for the last, several years, I spend my day job obsessing over and mimicking dialogue and trying to understand really the emotional components of dialogue. Where I work, we simulate conversations like suicide prevention conversations, or high stakes interrogation for law enforcement, or like simpler things like job interview training for neurodiverse people, right? Like these hard conversations that people have to have that you want to get right the first time. We simulate those so that they can practice them before they get them right the first time. And what my company does really well is we do artificial emotion. So we simulate our characters that we write have a really complex emotional matrix. And so it's really forced me to dig into why people say what they say, and how they say it, and the emotionality behind what they're saying. And that has been a beautiful pair for writing fiction, because as I'm processing how people talk during the day, you know, when I write at night, I'm able to say, like, okay, how do I use what I learned today to tell a story? How do I use what I learned today to create an emotional journey for a reader that they're going to go on, which is all, you know, I would argue is all our fiction is. We're just taking our reader on an emotional journey with a character. And so the two created a nice marriage to kind of bring me where I am now. So, you know, I write novels, and I for the intense rebel skeptic in me can't seem to focus on a genre, so I just bounce all over the world. During the day, I obsess over helping people have hard conversations better. And then I do editing as well. So as the dialogue doctor, I take what I learn during the day and I try to help other fiction writers. I started that about 2 years ago, taking what I've learned about emotionality, about really difficult conversations, about creating different character voices, about like talking about motivation and putting that into your dialogue in order to create a stronger emotional journey, to better engage your reader in the story. But yeah, so that's my writing path. I'm very happy where I am now. While I do have these moments where I find myself in book clubs trying to recapture something of some past identity that I used to have. Because there is, I think the thing about working in a religious sphere is that there's great confidence in what you do because you feel like you're on a mission for God. Mm. So being on that mission for God brings a sense of support and confidence that is like really, really assuring and comfortable. It's like, putting on, showing up with a title like that makes you feel great. And so there is part of me, I think, that it's always going to miss that. Always going to miss the assurance. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause if there's one thing that unites most writers in the world, not all, is a lack of self-assurance, like the level of self-doubt and imposter syndrome and the feeling of, oh my God, what am I doing, is very prevalent.
It's the worst. It's absolutely the worst. You just feel like, oh, this is like, does this work? Does this, like, down to the granular level, like, does this feel like I want it to feel? Are people going to read this like I want it to read? Whereas in my previous life, I always had the title. Right. Like I always had the position. I had the positional authority to justify what I wanted to do. So when that positional authority broke down, there's a weird longing for it. There's a weird, like, I miss being that person, and then there's also a self-hatred in that, like, there's a piece of it where it's like, I miss being that person, but I also really despise who that person was. That person did damage, right? Like I did damage when I was that person and I hurt people and I said stupid things and I led people down stupid paths. Mm. And so there's a reckoning of like, can I keep parts of it and, disregard the bad stuff? And for me, it does feel like I'm an addict, that I'm always like, watching somebody drink a beer and being like, can I drink that? Can I have one? Like, can I have one beer? And then just reminding myself, like, no, you take a sip out of that. And we're going back to, narcissistic tendencies and like all of these things that come along with a role of positional authority that can be dangerous for not everybody, but definitely was dangerous for me. So yeah, there's a weird, that's probably far deeper than you wanted to know into my story, but that's a weird, there's a weird thing there that's constantly grappling with. And I think as a writer, like you're saying, it is the other way. It's like, is this real? Am I real? Am I actually doing anything? Is this a profession? Mm-hmm. Will anybody ever buy this book? Please buy this book. Yeah, like, is that like, sense of like, who am I and how is it? And I don't think it's ever going to go away. Like, for a while I was like, well, if I just write the next book, it'll go away. If I just finish my first series, it'll go away. If I just hit this income level, it'll go away. It's never going away. Like, I'm just realizing that this is part of it. Every book I put out, I'm going to question, like, is this book real? And I'm going to question, is this my last one? Every time, I don't know if you have that, but every time I finish a book, I'm like, okay, am I done now? Like, am I finished? And I haven't been yet. Like, I finished this one and I have two outlines for two more books in my head. So it's like, I'm not done. But I think there is that looming question of like, maybe this isn't who I am. Maybe this was just a phase that, like, I don't know that I'll ever stop living with. If you are an author and you can't stop living with it, please write a book and tell the rest of us how to do that. Cause I can't figure it out.
I definitely had a point after I finished my first series where I didn't have any more ideas immediately. You know, I'd been so consumed with writing this one series. And even though I'd written the four novels and then a bunch of short stories and novellas around it, I got to the end and was like, is that it? Was it just that one story? And it was about a year, a bit more than a year before I really wrote anything again, because it was, yeah, I was scared that I just had that one story in me and it was done. Yeah.
Did you have that like sense of panic of like, oh, I'm not a writer anymore?
Yeah.
It's really scary. It feels like you're looking over a cliff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How'd you get inspiration for your next one?
I had just this little kernel of an idea, which was just that there's a psychic girl who she has to keep everyone at arm's length because touching people brings on these invasive, intrusive visions. Nice. And that was really all I had. And then I kind of thought, well, maybe like it could be like a buddy cop thing. She ends up partnering with like a member of Interpol to solve supernatural crimes. That was like the initial idea. And then it completely changed. It's nothing like that.
But that's beautiful though. Like all you needed was like the kernel in the oil to start popping the popcorn, right? Like that's all And I think there's something in that of like, we need to have trust in ourselves, as hard as it is. Like we need to trust our instincts. We need to trust these ideas that come to us and let them, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert in her book, Big Magic, talks about like trusting the muse, which is a beautiful, if you're struggling with that kind of like self-doubt and where's the next idea going to come from. I think that's a great book to read, but it's that like, you know, just having trust in the muse, knowing that like, if you treat the muse well, that she's not going to let you down. And I think it's a constant tug of war between like, is this real, and having faith that like, if I like this story, there will be someone else in the world that likes this story, right? Like at least one other person. No man is an island unto themselves. Like there will be someone else that enjoys the story.
But finding those people. But that's a whole other conversation.
Let's talk about that. Oh my gosh.
Let's close that door. Okay.
You're going to run for like 5 hours. Like, difficulties of marketing. I have this beautiful story. Yeah. I feel like there's that old musical Oliver where their kids like standing in the street like, you know, who will buy this wonderful feeling? I feel like that all the time. I'm like, could somebody, I have this amazing feeling. Will somebody just buy it, please? Yeah. I'll give it away. You can just have it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. All right. So.
Yeah. Hey, I warned you. I will rant. You got to cut me off.
We're away. It's the longest introduction I've ever had in an interview.
Right. And we're done. Interview's over. All right. See
you guys. Okay. So when it comes to writing topics that stir up a lot of intense feelings like religion, what can writers do to tackle those subjects with sensitivity?
Oh, that's a great question. I think when you're any kind of fictionalized memoir, right? Like, so the book I just wrote is a fictionalized memoir about my journey in deconstructing religion. In the journey of like sparks igniting in the world around me that caused me to rethink, who am I in this world? Like, what is my identity? Who have I made myself out to be? Anytime you're going on a self journey like that with fiction, I think you need to be prepared for you need to be prepared for how you're going to have to dig into the emotional pain. Mm. So if you're going to write about your divorce, right? Like you're going to write a fictionalized version of your divorce, just know that you're going to relive those emotions as you try to convey them to a reader. And there's something incredibly therapeutic about that. Like that's why I did that. Like I started writing this. My first series is an urban fantasy, dark urban fantasy. My second series is a supernatural detective series. So like this was my first fictionalized memoir, but I had this deep compulsion to write it because we were in COVID and I was questioning like, who in the hell am I and what is going on and what is happening in my world? and who am I for my kids and my family and all that kind of stuff. And like, my kids are, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, my kids are like asking me deep questions about life, and I have teenagers, so they're already like probing the depths. So for me, it was like, yeah, I need to dig into this. Like, this is what my brain, my soul right now is like, this is what you need to dig into, mm-hmm. is this idea of like, what happens when the institutions we trust fall apart mm-hmm. around us. So, or what happens when we realize the institutions we love aren't what we think they are. But all that to say, when you're doing that kind of emotional depth, just, you know, gird your loins, be prepared that like, this is going to hurt. Mm-hmm. And I think the more community and support you can set up around you before you start plumbing those depths, the better. The more, you know, I know y'all say in the Unstoppable Author's intro that you don't have to do this alone. That's super true in a fictionalized, when you're fictionalizing a memoir, you don't have to do it alone. Tell people what you're doing. Like, let them know, hey, I'm going to probe my divorce in fiction. And like, I may be a little crazy for the next year. I may just need to talk to you about things. Like, set those support systems up in advance. I told my wife when I started, I was like, I think I'm going to write that story. And her response was like, really? I was like, yeah, well, I'm going to do that. And so like, just prepare the people around you. Like, this is what I'm doing. And I may just need like special care. If you see me weeping in a corner, don't take it personally. It doesn't have anything to do with you. It has to do with me deciding to take a knife into my soul. Peace out. But I think a lot of us enter a fictionalized memoir not realizing that we're going to do that, that we're going to like really dig into who we are in order to write this. I also think we get into it thinking we understand ourselves in the story. So the other thing is like, that I would recommend for self-care going into a fictionalized memoirs, recognize that you're doing therapy, right? Like, you and the muse are going to work out a little bit who you are, mm-hmm. and how you've positioned yourself in the world and what's right and what's wrong about that. And you have to be open to that. You have to be open to questioning your own role in this story and question, because, you know, nobody wants to read a fictionalized memoir that says, nobody wants to read any story in which the hero says, I was right, everyone else sucks, look at how they all suck, I was always right, I'm right at the end, they all suck, right? Like, nobody wants to read that. So you have to push yourself to get deeper into like, who am I in this story? What was my role in these people's lives? What is their role in my life? As probing that emotional. So I think, you know, being prepared for what you're getting into, understand what you're doing, knowing that this is going to be a form of therapy for you, where you're trying to understand the world around you and your own self in it, is going to start you off in a really great way. And then I think the third and last recommendation I'd make is have support systems ready for when you're down, mm-hmm. right? Like, I gained 15 pounds writing this book because I'm a stress eater. Mm-hmm. So I would write a chapter. You know, part of what I processed as I was writing this book was my own role in systemic racism. And like, as a white evangelical pastor, it's a badge of honor. People may not like this part. If you're an evangelical, I apologize in advance. You probably don't want to read my book unless you want to question what you're doing. There's a thing in American church culture where white evangelical pastors go into the inner city on quote unquote mission to save the quote unquote poor. But because of the horrific history of America, people of color tend to be the ones that we have forced and isolated into those urban environments. So there brings a strange racism into it of the white savior complex. So in writing this book, part of what I was doing was probing my own white savior complex, not because, as Bo Burnham says, you know, rich white people need to understand every crisis through their own myopic lens of how it determines their own self-actualization. That's not what I was doing. More was a like confession for me, and an attempt to honor people that I had treated poorly in a moment to be like, hey, I'm going to point at this so that other people don't do this. So, like, it's a way to be like, stop this. Stop doing this thing. So that being said, though, I think, sorry, I lost my train of thought. Oh, so probing that kind of thing, you need that, like, I would write a chapter about my own participation in systemic racism and then go eat a tub of ice cream because I wanted to feel different than that chapter made me feel. So yeah. I think if you're going to get into writing fictionalized memoir where you're trying to put your experience on the page, make sure you've got some healthy ways to handle those emotions. Because there were a lot of times where, like, I'd finish a chapter and I'd just be crying because I'd be like, this is what I did to people. This is what, you know, this system does to people. This is the feeling, or like tough conversations that I was, you know, rebuilding. Like, none of the book is true, right? Like, let's be clear, it is fiction. Nothing in the book is real, but it is all true at the same time, if that makes sense. And I think a good fictionalized memoir is that way. None of the characters are real. The character that represents me is not actually me. None of the things that happen in the book are things that I did, but they all represent emotional moments and understandings and feelings that I experienced and had, which is what makes it that, like, memoir aspect, is that I'm telling my story through a completely different story. So in probing those, like, having healthy ways to handle the emotions that are going to come, you know, if you went through a messy divorce and you're writing a book about a divorce, knowing that, like, I'm going to have to write that scene where the couple has that moment in which they both confess that one of them says this is over and the other one doesn't want it to be. And there's that hurt, pain. You're going to relive that pain as you write that moment. So just be prepared to, like, have a strategy of, like, when I'm weeping at my laptop at 10 p.m., how do I go to bed? Right? Like, what happens when I go to bed? In essence, don't be me. Don't eat a tub of ice cream. Go do something else. Right? Like, figure out. But I think having those healthy, like, self-care strategies when you're probing emotional depths are really important.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've described this as this book as a deconstruction of religion. What do you mean by that?
Holly, how much do you want to know?
Start a timer. You've got 10 minutes.
Okay. How much do you know about the evangelical church in America? No, I'm just kidding. Not really. That's probably a good place to start. So, because I know you're in the UK, so, and I know you have a lot of international listeners, and deconstruction is a term that's being thrown around a lot. So I can do people a service here. So US 1950s, coming out of, you know, two world wars and the Great Depression, had this, like, social, who are we? Beautiful Things birthed out of that, right? Like, the civil rights movement birthed out of that. Like, who are we? And the LGBTQ movement birthed out of who are we, right? Like, the pride movement of, like, we will not be oppressed anymore by the society birthed out of that. Lots of great social justice movements birthed out of that, right? Like, the care for the homeless, the care for the radical change in how we deal with people who are struggling with mental disabilities, right? Like, all of that birthed out of that moment. What also birthed out of that moment was the American Evangelical Church, centered around Billy Graham. And if you really want to get deep into the history, there's a fantastic book called Jesus, John Wayne, and How the Rise of the American Church, How the Rise of the American Evangelical Church Fractured a Nation, by Kristen DeMunez, I think her name is. I think I'm getting that right. Fantastic book that goes into this history way more deeper than I am. But there's a component of America, primarily white America, that was like, well, as we rediscover who we are, we need to recenter on our faith and religion. And so some things became very important: a focus on the afterlife as opposed to the present life, on salvation, a focus on what is termed the Great Commission, and that we need to be going out saving souls. We need to be actively saving souls. And then all these ways to do that. And like what, and like things birthed out of that, like, oh, there's these magic words you can say, the believer's prayer. When you say these magic words, your soul is suddenly saved to heaven for all of eternity, right? Like all of that comes out of like the Billy Graham movement in the 1950s. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it, in reaction to the civil rights movement, in reaction to the gay rights movement, it becomes increasingly conservative, increasingly isolated in the suburbs. And then in the 80s, capitalism gets involved and like the American megachurch is born. What's called the church growth movement happens. So a lot of people like me grew up in that stream of thinking. That was just the water we swam in, right? Like I started going to church. I started attending an evangelical church when I was, I think I went to my first church when I was a month old, right? Like my mom was like, hey, we're going to church. And I was like a baby in the nursery, right? Like probably a week old now that I think about it. And I grew up, you know, when the doors were open, I was there. And so that world, that perspective was all I knew. And when you grow up in that world, you don't understand necessarily what life is like outside of that world, because it is very much a bubble. And the goal of that world is to bring to it. And if they're not in it, then there's something wrong with them and they're broken. Mm-hmm. So deconstruction is the process. The term primarily refers to those of us who grew up in that kind of religious, in America, that evangelical American context, encountering people typically in your like 20s, when you're in your 20s and 30s, encountering people around you that are like, oh, these people are different than me. And they're not the like heathens that need to be saved that I was taught they were. And then that leads you to, and whether it's like an initial encounter with, you know, beautiful people in the LGBTQIA movement, or whether it's like an encounter with people that are in different socioeconomic stances than you are, where you're like, oh, this is more complex than like they need Jesus, right? Like, so it starts with a spark where you realize like, oh, the world isn't what I thought it was. And then that spark tends to cause you to rethink everything, because it is like a house of cards. You pull one out of the bottom and the whole thing starts to fall down. You know, for me, deconstruction started in the early 2000s when it wasn't very popular. So like I started my journey in it, and you know, I had people holding interventions. They were like, I had pastors like, hey, do you want to go to coffee? And I'd show up to coffee and there'd be like three pastors there who all wanted to talk to me about how I was getting on the wrong course and my life was on the wrong journey. And I needed to stop asking the question why all the time. Now there's been a beautiful, I think as this ball has started to roll and, you know, have started to talk about it more and more, there's been a beautiful kind of community formed around it, where there's a whole generation now asking, why did we do this? And what does this mean? And look at the damage that this has caused in the world. And so it is having, I don't know if it's a movement or a moment. It's always hard to tell from when you're in it. I hope it's a movement. I hope it's not just a moment. But that's what deconstruction is. I think, as we apply it to our writing, because I know this is not a religious podcast. This is a podcast for authors. As we, they're like, yeah. Get to the dialogue, doctor. Oh, as we apply it to our writing, you know, I think writing about deconstruction, writing about any kind of world tearing down, we can talk about the general concepts, but the most important thing for a writer to consider as they dive into that conversation about like, how am I going to write the deconstruction of religion, or how am I going to write a coming of age story in this fantasy world, or how I'm going to write like any kind of like, I'm going to tear down the system. What's important is the character's individual experience in that world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my book is about the deconstruction of religion. My book is not about the deconstruction of religion for the reader. That's the theme that runs underneath it. Mm-hmm. Ideally, what the reader reads is, Tim and Abby have this hurt, like painful and humorous, heartwarming journey of self-discovery as they interact with people that aren't like them, and they're forced to make choices about which side they're going to take in understanding those people. So they encounter homeless people, they build relationships with those recovering addicts who are living in a shelter. And they're told one thing by the people that represent the culture they're coming from, and then they have to decide whether or not they're going to accept that. They meet a trans person, and they have this history of their own beliefs around trans people, but they haven't ever actually encountered a person who is trans before. And so as they meet this neighbor and fall in love with this neighbor as this beautiful human, they have to reckon with who they were in the past, right? Like, and who they, and that's this, that's really the story of deconstruction, right? Like, we can go the historical lens, be like, oh, there's all this history around it, but what readers care about and what readers want to know is that individualized journey of a person through this experience of challenging the world around them. What are the challenges they face? What are the choices they're making in comparison to those challenges? And then what are the consequences of those choices? So writing Deconstruction of Religion, you know, the consequence of the choices, have to choose between the community and what you feel is true and what you feel is right. And that's the journey that the characters go on in my book, is like, they keep coming to these challenges and they start to stack, where it's like, I don't see these recovering addicts like the world sees them. I don't see this trans person like the world sees them. There's a young woman in the book who's struggling with whether or not to have an abortion. And there's the words of the culture that they come from, represented by three characters saying, like, this is how that woman should be viewed. But then there's the actual interactions with that woman, with my protagonist, my vehicle characters, saying, like, but I love her and I understand who she is and where she is. And the decision doesn't seem to be what you're making it out to be. So creating that tension for your characters between the world with them, and then having them have to make a choice, right? Drawing lines in the sand and having the consequences of that choice being like, are you going to be inside or outside? And there are, you know, painful and negative consequences to being outside. There's comfort to being inside. Mm-hmm. And I think that doesn't just apply to like a religious deconstruction novel, but to any coming of age novel, even if it's like high school students deciding whether they're going to sit with the popular crowd or the nerds. Right? Like, the real tension there is, do I leave the safety of my community in order to do what I think is true? Or do I live in the safety of the community in the hypocrisy of what I know? Right? Like, and being, I think books and stories that do it really, really well help us as the consumer of the story understand the pain of that choice. Because it feels natural on paper, right? Like, well, I don't want to be a hypocrite, so of course I go the other way. But, you know, if you really want your reader to feel it, you need to show what the person loses by leaving that community, by stepping away from that family, and the pain of walking out of, you know, walking outside of that circle is tough. And is, you know, redefining. And so I think a lot of self-discovery stories at best end with like, well, we're going to start a new adventure now, right? Because, that, you know, ending with like, everything's okay, isn't honest, right? Ending with like, this is, I am happy with the choice I've made, or I'm satisfied with the choice I've made, the pain, and now I'm going to start a new adventure, is a more honest self-discovery story, right? Like, yeah, looking back. And I think when you're writing that story, you always need a moment where you, in the end, where you have your vehicle character, your protagonist, look back on the community they left and feel satisfied with leaving. The reader needs that kind of conclusion.
Yeah,
to take that into like seven different directions. Sorry, Holly, you asked me one question, I'm like, I'm gonna go over there. But I, you know, I do think self-discovery stories are beautiful, but they are that like exploration of self-understanding. So it's that, yeah, that whether it's about religion or about a, you know, I mean, Mean Girls in the end is a self-discovery story where she's trying to decide who, what crowd she's going to be with. And you feel the benefits of being with the insiders and the pain of leaving the insiders, but then the acceptance of that pain in order to be honest to how you see the world as. But yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So, I mean, you've written this from the perspective of your journey. You've already left the religious community that you were raised in, more or less.
If you ever really escape, it's a little like the Godfather 3. Every time I get back, they pull me back in. Like, it's that kind of like,
But for writers who are still part of a religious community who want to explore some of this and they want to explore their own faith and perhaps come at religion from a more critical standpoint, how can they do that? Can they do that without upsetting their community? And how might they go about doing
that? It's really funny. Can a romance writer write erotica without, horrifying their mother? Right? Like, I don't know. Depends on who your mom is. So I would say the key to write, I may have a child join me here in a second. He's bringing me Starbucks and a donut.
Katie got these.
Thank you. I have Starbucks and a donut here. Thank you. I mean, I'm sorry to have my podcast interrupted by my six-year-old, but he brought me Starbucks and a donut, so I'm not going to complain. So the key to like, probing. So I think the question is, like, how do you probe this in an honest way so that when your community reads it, they don't feel betrayed?
Yeah.
They feel like this is an honest exploration of things we're doing. And I really do think the character level and know that you're not writing about the system. So, and I think this is something like when I edit authors, like, I've been doing the Dialogue Doctor now for almost 2 years, and I've worked with, well over 100 authors on their stuff. And I think, it's the same issue we face with like magic systems or like fantasy worlds. As authors, we get very excited about designing the magic system, right? Like we get very excited about how the powers work and whose powers do what and how, this person's powers work this way, but she has to squint her eyes, right? Like, and we get real excited about those details. But what the reader cares about is the emotional journey of that character. And the magic system is actually just a tool to take us on that journey. Mm-hmm. It's furniture in the room that the reader is interacting with. So you can spend 1,000 pages describing the curtains, but the reader doesn't care. The reader cares about what the character is feeling and what the character is doing in the room. And so when it comes to writing your religious system, when it comes to probing, your own experience and the depths of your own experience, take it to the motivations of the characters. You can have your religious system. Like, yeah, I wanted to talk about abortion because, man, that's a problem in my world. I wanted to talk about like the way that we handle it, the way we talk about it. It is a painful and stupid and world-causing problem in my world. I wanted to talk about racism because that is a problem. I wanted to talk about the treatment of trans people, right? Like I have dear, dear friends who are trans, and I see how behavior hurt people like them. And so I want to bring that pain to the surface in my work, right? Like, and show that, like, hey, so I want to probe how my religious system treats people that are different than they are. But I can't, if I'm going to write paragraphs about that, I need to write a nonfiction book, right? Like if I'm addressing the religious system, then I need to write an essay on Medium about abortion. If you want to write a novel, you have to identify the characters, their motivations, and the challenges that are going to happen to them that bring that theme out, right? Like, so I wanted to write about abortion. So I have Abby, and I was like, well, Abby grew up in a system that considers this evil all the time with no questions and no actual discussion. It is just evil. And then so I want to bring out that challenge. So I'm like, well, I need a character who is going to experience something that is going to challenge Abby's perception. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a character, I built a relationship between her and Abby, and then I lead that character to a place where Abby's beliefs are going to be challenged if she's going to continue to live with that character, right? Mm-hmm. Because what the reader is going to connect with is Abby's emotional journey, yeah. Not a diet. If they want to read about religion, then they're going to read about they're going to go by, you know, Jesus, John Wayne, and the Rise of the Evangelical Right, right? Like, if they want to read about religion, that's the book they're going to read. The fiction readers are coming for this journey that Abby's going to have. And so I think I'm trying to answer the question saying that, like, if you write about a religious system, take it down to the character journey, to the motivations of the character, challenge those characters' motivations, challenge their perceptions in the text, in the storyline, build your plot around, like, how do you challenge these things? And then ideally the community that you're in understands, oh, this is an honest conversation, a real conversation about this thing that we struggle. They may disagree with the conclusions your characters land on, but at least you can say, I was just trying to be honest about what our experience is in this. And I had one reader recently post on Goodreads, I wish he had written a memoir and not a novel. And part of me is like, you don't understand, my story is actually way boring. Right? Like, my story is not as exciting as the story. This story is more exciting than my story. You don't actually want to read my story. My story is about a lot of Jeff sitting in an office contemplating life as he, like, looks at a computer screen. That's not fun. This story is fun. So, but there is that, like, when you're writing about your community, even if you are writing what I've been calling a fictionalized memoir, where I'm going to take my experience and my truth and put it into this story, I would recommend divorcing it completely from your story and writing a plot that brings out the themes that you want to challenge. And that will help in dealing with your community, because they're not going to find themselves represented in it, ideally, right? Like, what you don't want is you don't want to write a fiction story and then pass it to somebody and they go, yeah, I see Bill on page 5. Like, you don't want to do that. Just, if you're going to do that, just write their story, right? Like, don't just write your story and change everybody's names. Reconstruct a plot that's going to address the themes that you want to address in order to bring that out. That'll make it easier for your community to digest, if that makes sense. Because then the work is about the themes and is about the truth that you want to talk about, not about your story. Yeah. Does that make sense? And there's that, like, transition that will help you engage with your community. But again, is your mom going to be okay with erotica? I don't know. Some communities are super closed, and if you say anything bad about them, they're kicking you out. So, like, just, weigh the consequences, gird your loins, and jump in. Like, it's that kind of, like, where do you want to, what are you going to do? If you're so nervous about being kicked out of your community that you're going to pull punches, you're probably not ready to write that story. Mm. If you're so nervous that you're like, well, I want to say this, but I'm afraid to say this because of how they'll react, take more time. Write something else, right? Mm-hmm. Go write a detective series. That's what I did. go write a detective thriller. And then come back to it, right? Like, because the truth is, and I think this is hard for us as authors because, there is that door we closed around marketing and getting the next book out. And like, oh my gosh, I have to keep the books flowing. I have to keep my readers engaged. There is a false urgency around your storytelling. Mm. No one is waiting for this story, right? No one is sitting around being like, when are they going to write that story about religion? Nobody's doing that. So if you're not ready to write it, write something else and keep it on the back burner and keep it stewing until you are ready, right? Like, because you don't want to rush it. I actually wrote a version of this story was my first novel, and it's terrible, and it should not have been written, and it shouldn't have been published. I had no idea what the themes were I was talking about. I was just angry ranting about things. It is a bad book. It is terrible. So, you know, I am speaking from experience here, and that, like, I had to get away from it for a decade before I was ready to be like, okay, here's what I want to say to my community. And, you know, that's, as I stumbled upon this, that's another thing that I think you recommend is, who are you talking to, right? Like, for me, I wrote this story, it's going to sound weird, but I wrote this story specifically for clergy who are living this every day. Because I know clergy who live in the system that are like, the system's broken, but leaving is going, like going to the outside, leaving the inside, going to the outside is going to cause me to lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote this to like, this is my, and I actually, you know, I give it away free to clergy. So if you're a pastor, you just go to my website and download a free copy. Anybody can. I can't actually limit who you are, but don't do it. You know, come on. It's $2.99. Buy a copy. But if you're clergy, like, I want you to read it. And I have a letter in there that's like, hey, you're seen, you're heard. Like, we see your struggle. And, like, you know, get out. But, like, I had a specific audience in mind as I was writing this theme. Like, I think it works for everybody. I've put it to a lot of beta readers, and the reviews are coming in. They seem really great. But I was like, who this, I think when you're deconstructing anything, when you're pulling something apart in your life, it's better to do it as a love letter than an angry rant.
Mm.
So if you can express it as a love letter to somebody, to be like, I see you, I hear you, here's my like gift to you to help you know that I feel your struggle and you can come out the other side of this. Mm. Right? Like, you know, I think shaping your thoughts around, this is my love letter to you, as opposed to this is me pointing out everything that's wrong in your world, is going to make it far more digestible to your community when it's done, because I believe that heart will come through your work. Mm. That heart will come through and say, no, this is somebody who actually deeply cares about us, that wants this to go well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, on a similar trajectory, what can we practically do as writers when it comes to getting feedback? Like, how do you approach potential readers with these potentially quite confrontational ideas, and engage with them in a sensitive way without offending them?
It's a fascinating question, because I think a lot of that question depends about where we are in our writing career.
Mm.
Right? Like, you know, if you've been writing, I mean, you have 7 books out, 8 books out. Is that right? No, more. You have 9. I was counting earlier.
How do you
know
easier than, like, quicker than me? I have 5 novels, 2 novellas, and a nonfiction.
So I was 1 off your page. I was counting earlier. You know, so I'm sure you, and I know I have a system built, because like I've had, you know, 12 books to try to figure out like, how do I get it to read? So, you know, I'm going to give you my solution, but I want to say that to say, like, if you're a first time author, this is an unfair solution for you. So I'll give you what I do, and then we can talk about like what a first time author does. So for me, I have different types of readers that I know. So like, I have now a body of readers that I have on an email list that I email all the time. A lot of them I've built relationships with in my email list. I'm like, hey, tell me your story. I want to get to know you, right? Like, so I have a community that I've built around my work. Mm-hmm. Over a 12-year period. So I know people in that community and kind of how they interact with my work and who they are. I don't know all of them, but I have like readers that I interact with on a routine basis. So for me, with this work specifically, it was like, okay, I'm deconstructing these themes. I want people on either side of these themes to read this book who trust me and know me to engage with the themes. Mm-hmm. Now that's one type of reading that, like, I want you to engage with the themes. So I found people that are still inside my religious construction that I know like reading my work. So it's not a question of like, do they like my writing? It's a question of like, do they like this particular writing?
Yeah.
And I was able to engage them and be like, hey, would you read these chapters for me? Would you read these? And then other chapters, like, I have readers who represent in some way, not represent, that's a terrible word, not represent, some way connect with the character that I'm writing, right? So trans character in the book. I, as a cis white heterosexual male in his 40s, have no business writing the experience of a trans character, right? So I wrote my trans character chapters. Before I wrote them, I reached out to my trans friends and I said, I'm doing this thing. How do you feel about me doing this thing? Please be honest before I do it. And B, after I do this thing, would you be willing to read it and give me your honest, unbiased opinion about that character's experience and if I'm hitting it right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to set those kind of sensitivity readers up before you write. You don't want to write and then go look for them. Because that's unfair to them, right? Like, you, so set them up before you. And so I had a few of them say, like, yeah, I'm down for that journey with you. Now they're those are close friends who, like, I've been on this journey with. So they, I have some trust there that they're going to tell me the truth. And so, you know, and they did. I wrote it and I gave it to them and they showed up. I may have it around here. I don't. They showed up with like this, because they asked me to print it off. They showed up with like this printed manuscript and it's like covered in red ink. And they were like, this is all wrong. I had to write those chapters four times before I got that character's experience to a way where my friends would say, like, this doesn't represent all trans people in any way, shape, or form. That's not our goal, but it is authentic to a trans person's experience. Right? Like, it does, you are getting closer. This is why that male, you're getting closer to it. But I think, so being willing to like set those readers up and do the work around the chapter, finding readers that represent the different communities in your book, and the different perspectives in your book, and asking them like, how does this make you feel? Knowing that sometimes, like when I gave it to a conservative pastor, I was like, hey, read these chapters for me and tell me how you feel about this. They were like, that makes me really uncomfortable. Like, I was like, oh, okay, thanks. But inside I'm like, yes, like that's what I wanted. I want that to make you really uncomfortable. So like understanding like what you're going for. That's in the formation. And then post-formation, you know, getting it into the hands of readers to read and review. Once you're done writing and you've put it into the world, you're kind of out of control of it, right? Like, and I've actually had some readers read it and what I would say draw the wrong conclusion from it. This is why no one should ever leave the community. And I'm like, no, that's not. But I'm totally out of control of that, right?
Yeah.
Now, again, that's coming from me, who's built a community of readers around my work for 12 years. If you're just starting out, well, so first let me say, if you are going to write about a community you are not a part of, go and be a part of that community first, right? Like, you know, don't, if you've never been to Australia and you don't know any Australian people and you haven't done research on what life in Australia is like, don't write a book about life in Sydney, right? Like, do the work. Do the homework. It doesn't mean you have to fly to Sydney because that's cost prohibitive, but it does mean that you got to do the work and actually like get into the life of that person if you want it to be authentic to them, right? Yeah. Like, so, you know, and I'm using Australia as a benign example, but we can just let your mind fly to all the other kind of examples that people are like, I'm going to write a book about X. Mm-hmm. If you don't know X, do the work, do the intellectual work to get to know X before you write X. Fill in whatever you want in X. And then, you know, as a new reader, as a new writer finding readers, just know that you're going to have to give your work away a lot. Mm-hmm. And that I think the other thing to know, like, you have to get used to understanding reader feedback, because readers aren't writers. So like a lot of times people will come to me and they'll be like, this reader told me it was boring. And it's like, okay, the answer to boring may not be, I need to add car explosions, right? The answer to boring may be your character voices all sound the same. Mm. And so they're not engaging with characters. The answer to boring may be your chapters don't have any choices the characters are making. So we can tell the same story and just add some choices, right? Like, so I think the key for a new writer is get that reader feedback, but then talk to other authors about what that feedback means. Yeah. Because ideally authors that are more experienced than you, and there's 1,000 amazing communities you can be a part of, right? Like Unstoppable Authors is a great community you can be a part of, where you can talk to authors that are further along than you in their journey. Mm. And you can say like, this reader told me it doesn't make sense. And then that author, I promise, is going to be like, a reader told me once it doesn't make sense. And this is what I had to do to fix that. And it gives you the perspective to like, look at it and say, what is that? I think, when you're first starting out, it is harder. It's tough to build that community, but also know that none of us started with a community of readers, right? Like there is no magic bullet to be like, okay, I'm going to pay this person $500. And now I have a community of 1,000 readers that I trust and can trust. And it takes time. And like, it takes years to build. So I think that goes back to the identity of us as a writer. To bring it full circle, to bring the conversation full circle back to who we are. You know, if this is part of who you are, even if it's a hobby and not a career, understand that this is a long haul, right? Like nobody picks up a baseball bat and is, you know, Babe Ruth. That's not how that works. There's decades of learning to swing that bat, and you're going to put books out that you're going to look back on and be like, oh, that's crap. And you're going to put books out that you're going to look back on and you're going to be like, man, I wish I could capture that magic again. Whatever I put in that bottle, is it? I need to get that back. But there's that, like, it is a process and a journey, and building your readership is that kind of journey where you're like building a relationship with people of like, I'm a storyteller and you are a story consumer. And we're simpatico in that way. And so I would love to build trust with you over time. And there are times where I'm going to give you things that you don't like, and I need to listen to your feedback. And by the way, no reader stays for your whole journey. When I talk about like, oh, I have these groups of readers, they're always in flux. They're like, I think there's one person that I can say has read every single one of my books and has stayed with me the whole time. Now, part of that's because I can't decide on a genre, so it's like, no, I'm gonna write this. But readers have lives, they come and go, they have things going on, life changes, especially over a decade of writing. How many friends do you have that have been friends, strong friends for a decade? Probably like 2 or 3, right? Like we don't have 50 people that we've known all of our lives and that we're close to and have a trust relationship with. So just know that like building relationships with readers is like building friendships. It takes time and trust and, you know, mutual consideration and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's I just rambled like 5 answers to your one question.
It's great, because I had a whole load of other questions, but you've actually answered them all without me having to ask them. So, you know, that's great.
Nice. Yeah.
So I do have a little crafty question.
Ooh, okay.
How do you show rather than tell a character's faith? It's not enough just to say, oh, this character is Christian. Yeah. Well, how do we show it?
So you're about to get the dialogue, Dr. Bias, and this, and the answer is through dialogue. I think understanding that, at the dialogue doctor, we talk about the dialogue daisy that make up your character. So your character, picture your character as a daisy, and there's components to that daisy. there's the roots, and the roots are the character's worldview, the character's family history, the character's genetics, the character's magical power, the character's, you know, place in society, all of that stuff that when we say we're going to build a character book, that's, we tend to focus there. And so the character's faith falls into that root system. That root system needs to grow into a stem. And that stem is the character's personality. So think of your character's personality as a expression to the world based on where they've come from. Now, that is not scientifically what a personality is, but for our writer's brain, think of your personality that way. So if your character has grown up in faith and always feels like an outsider inside of that faith, how have they positioned themselves in the world? How do they interact with that world? Are they shy? Do they hide because they're afraid of being an outsider? Or are they aggressively outspoken and, you know, a rebel that's a little happy when they feel rejected, right? Like, what is the personality shaping? And then from that personality blooms the character voice. The character voice is how that personality is expressed when they talk with others. It's what does that personality sound like, which is the question we rarely get to as an author, but it's actually the most important question, is what does that person sound like in the world? If there's a shy person, you know, that person's going to speak in like one sentence at a time. They're not going to enter the conversation very often. They might have a rich inner thought life that's represented. So they might have like a paragraph of thinking and then like a one sentence verbal expression. Right? Like,
yeah.
that is an expression of a anxiously shy person who feels out of place in their faith, right? Mm-hmm. The aggressive rebel who's open is going to be aggressive in their conversations. They're going to speak first. They're going to have a little Huck Finn in them. They're not going to be afraid to say the thing that nobody wants to hear. Right? Like, and they're not just going to say it in a conversation. They're going to be the first to say it. They're probably going to say it a little too early, and they're going to say it with two or three sentences instead of one. Right? And in the pacing of the conversation, like how often that person has an utterance, like let's say you have three characters in the conversation, a shy person might speak every four exchanges. Mm-hmm. Right now, they might, if you're doing inner monologue, that inner monologue can be rolling the whole time, but their exterior voice is only going to come out every three or four exchanges. Whereas the aggressive rebel, their voice is going to come out every exchange, right? Like they're engaged in that conversation because they want the fight. So that being said, how you express the character's relationship with faith is how you design that character's voice in order to show the reader the character's personality, in order to show the reader their place in the culture around them. Because mm-hmm. again, like going back to what you're writing when you write a religious system, you're writing the religious system is the furniture the character exists around. So how does the character interact with that furniture? Are they soft and cozy in the furniture? Do they love it? Is it super comfortable? They like to lay on that religion couch? Or do they have some disdain for the furniture and they don't want to sit on the religion couch? And they look at the religion couch with a side eye all the time, right? Like, but what the reader wants is how the character's reacting to the furniture, not the furniture itself. So understanding your character's personality as an expression of how they exist in that world system, and then expressing that personality through how the character sounds in conversations, that's showing, not telling.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What you don't want to do is write passages where you're like, Sally hated religion. Don't tell me Sally hated religion. Give me a scene where some religious ritual is happening, and then show me how Sally interacts with that religious ritual going on. What are Sally's inner thoughts around that religious ritual? When Sally's asked to participate, what choice does she make in that participation? The rebel Sally is going to be like, you know, no, this ritual sucks and I'm not doing it. Sally and mom are going to be like, Sally, not today. The rebel Sally is going to be like, mom, back off. You know this sucks. You and I talked about it yesterday at dinner. Sally mom's going to be like, shh, please keep our inside conversations inside, right? Like, That's how the religious Sally sounds. Whereas the shy Sally, they're going to be like, Sally, get up there and take communion. And the shy Sally is going to have this thought of like, I don't want to do this. This is very uncomfortable. I don't even like what this means. Right. Like that's the inner voice. And then the exterior voice is going to be like, shrug. Okay. Right. Like, and that's the shy voice that tells us like, oh, this is the journey we're going on. Now, knowing, here's the caveat, whatever voice you set up, that's the emotional journey that has to pay off. So if you're going to have Rebel Sally, who is openly rejecting the religion at the beginning of the story, then you've got to know your story isn't, like we said earlier about the divorce example, your story isn't Rebel Sally hates religion. Look at how much religion sucks. Rebel Sally is always right. Rebel Sally wins. Nobody wants to read that story. Right? Like even people that agree with that story don't want to read that story. They're like, yeah, I know. Right? So what you need in a story, if you have Rebel Sally, is Rebel Sally is rebelling against this. Rebel Sally has consequences to her rebellion. Rebel Sally has to make choices around those consequences. Rebel Sally feels the pain of those choices, right? The consequences are real. The stakes hurt, right? Mm-hmm. Rebel Sally comes out of that changed. More a rebel, more an activist, more, but fully separated from the community, is lost and feeling it's worth it. Or, right, the other plot direction for that Rebel Sally personality is, having made this decision, mourning the death of something, but excited about the new birth of something else, right? Like, whereas if you have shy Sally, if you start with shy Sally, then you got to know a shy character, that arc has to be about that character finding her voice. Mm. It has to be about that character finding her voice. That's what we want, right? Like it's the whole gun in the first act on the wall thing, right? If you put a gun in the first act on the wall, somebody better be shot in the face on the third act. I'm pretty sure that's how that quote goes. So it's the same. If you give me shy Sally struggling in a world system where she feels oppressed, you are writing a story about this character coming to life. Right. If you give me Rebel Sally bucking a system, you are writing a story of maturity where this character is learning about herself and growing about herself. If you give me and we can get away from the shy and rebel. If you give me fully embraced, excited Sally, which is actually the story that I wrote. Right. Fully embraced, excited Sally, who's all in on the culture that she is a part of. Then that story has to be a coming of age where she learns this isn't what I thought it was. And she grapples with that and makes choices about who she's going to be in this context and whether she can stay in this context anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, so however you set up that character's voice, know that is the story you're writing. You can reverse engineer that too. If you're like, I want to write a story about discovering problems with a thing and then staying in that religion, then know that you need to start with somebody who's all in. Discover the problems and then decide in the end that they'll stay all in, but they've matured in. If you're like, I want to write a rejection story, the birth of an activist, then maybe start shy and build, grow that character voice to give them a voice at the end, right? The question of how do we show this departure of religion? It all comes down to the character level. Mm-hmm. It's got to be at the character level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this has been such an in-depth conversation.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Ollie. I really appreciate you letting me. This is more, I think, inside outside. I've written a lot of novels. This is the first one that I can say like I actually passionately care about. The other ones were fun, and they were like, oh, I'm processing. I think every novel I've ever written, I'm processing some kind of theme, right? Like my detective novels, Mo, the lead detective, touches people and relives their memories. And when I wrote those, I was struggling with the idea of like, what is my past and how do I actually interpret it, right? Like, who am I in this past? So I'm always struggling with some kind of theme when I write something. This theme is the one where I'm like, you know what, we're not going to hide this behind a detective novel. We're just going to put this in your face. So thanks for letting me talk about it. It's important to me, so I appreciate it.
Okay, we're going to finish off in the traditional fashion for Unstoppable Authors with a would you rather question.
Yes. Okay, I'm ready.
So, and it is...
You didn't prep me in advance, so I'm excited.
No. Yeah. It is on theme, so...
Just know that I'm a rambler, so this might take an hour. Go ahead.
Okay, would you rather take a vow of silence for a whole year or eat nothing but bone broth for the rest of your life?
Oh, that's super easy. That's super easy because I don't like talking to people anyway. So a vow of silence for a whole year sounds fantastic. I would love that. Oh my gosh. I would spend my whole day with headphones on listening to music, speaking to no one. Like that's like my ideal life. So yeah, vow of silence for you. It's great. I would love nothing more. My wife is a super extrovert. I would love nothing more than to be able to go to a party with her and have like a card. This is like vow of silence for you. And just be like stand there and let people have their conversations and have an excuse not to interact. Just be like, that would be the best, all the best sign. And like, no, I can't talk. Plus, I'm a cook. I love cooking. I could not deal with only one flavor for a year. Like, you know. Food is a passion. Like I am one of my favorite things to do. I have 5 kids. One of my favorite things to do every night is to cook dinner for all 7 of us and force them to try weird tastes and flavors. Like recently I've been experimenting with different types of ramen and my poor 6-year-old is like, you know, can we just have grilled cheese? You can, but with pepper jack on it. Anyway, that's an easy one. I will take the vow of silence and eat whatever I want for a whole year.
I really thought that the dialogue doctor would struggle a bit more with that one.
No way. I like to mimic dialogue. I like to listen to other people talk. I love analyzing like people's emotional context, but I don't want to talk to people. No way. If I could live in a glass box and observe the world from it, that'd be the best. With my little notepad and pen, like taking notes. Yeah, I do joke with my friends all the time. They say something, I'm like, you know that's going to be in a book, right? What you just said, just be ready.
Awesome. Okay, finally, could you let our listeners know more, like where they can find more of you, your books, your podcast, and all of that?
Yeah, so the book we were talking about, Inside Outside, the coming of age in the American Evangelical Church is at anywhere you can buy ebooks. The paperback's coming out very soon, hopefully via Ingram Spark. If you want to read my fiction, it's jeffelkinswriter.com. If you want to engage more with dialogue and how to write dialogue and characterization and, you know, how characterization develops your plot, it's dialoguedoctor.com. I have a weekly podcast that comes out every Monday. There's a newsletter that's supposed to come out every Tuesday, but this week is coming out on Thursday. If you enjoy the podcast, you enjoy the newsletter and you want to go deeper, we have a community called the Dialoguers that you can find on dialoguedoctor.com by clicking that community button on there. And it has, there's a Slack and we do a weekly writing prompt and, do Zoom calls once a month. We have a good time together. So yeah, there's that. So there's all levels of engagement, any level you want. Yeah, as long as you don't ask me to talk to you. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Thank you, Jeff, so much. This has been amazing.
Yeah, thanks, Ollie. It was great.
Well, I really hope you enjoyed the interview. There was so much to cover, and honestly, I could have easily chatted with Jeff for another hour on this topic alone, never mind the work he does with other authors on his podcast, which I highly recommend. It's The Dialogue Doctor, and I've been listening to it a lot recently, and it's so, so helpful. Just a reminder of our question of the week. What kinds of sensitive topics have you addressed with your fiction? Also, if you've written fictionalised memoir or been inspired to try it, please let us know that too. All 3 of us will be back next week with our milestone 150th episode. You will not want to miss that. And remember, if you want to join us for Sprints and Giggles and get all of the other benefits of being a patron, you can do so over at patreon.com/unstoppableauthors.
Don't forget to share the podcast online and tag us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just search for Unstoppable Authors.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Unstoppable Authors podcast. We'll be back next week with more of our tenacity and worldly wisdom.
Don't forget to visit our website to get the show notes and heaps of helpful blog articles at unstoppableauthors.com.
And join our Guild of Unstoppable Authors, and you will not only hear from us every week, but you will also get a free digital copy of my book, 30 Days of Worldbuilding.
If you enjoyed the episode, please remember to subscribe and leave a review.